writing. And so when I was completely through with the book and I sent the manuscript in, then I wrote and told him I was coming back to New York, that I want to sit down and talk it over with him. We would edit it from there. And I thought, well, this would get me a trip I'll take out of the thing, because I told myself when I sold the manuscript and got the advance, I was going to buy myself a nice cashmere coat, spook coat. Well, of course, a real good one runs about $350. Well, I could pay for it. I could afford the damn thing, you know. And I went out, and I looked around. I walked through the backyard there, and I looked in my closet, and I had several sport coats. And I thought, what in the hell do you need with a cashmere sport coat? You've got sport coats? What, are you out of your mind or something? So I decided, well, I'd take this trip. And I love to travel by train. Maybe someday I'll get around to write this book that a fellow in Los Angeles wanted me to write on the old trains. Anyway, I got me a bedroom on the train to New York and back on the thing, took this trip. Well, I was having a wonderful time. I was going to write a story on that. So we get into Kansas City. They were there about 20 minutes at 5:30 in the morning. This was on a Sunday morning. So Saturday night before I went to bed, the car porter, I pet him, and I said, look, I said, when we get to Kansas City, I said, will you kind of rap on the door? He said, what's the matter? You all homesick? I said, no, I just... Well, I got up. He rapped on the door, and I got up, put my top coat on, over my pajamas, and I went back, and there's the old Union Station, and I began to cry. I guess I was a little homesick. I couldn't help it. So I went on to New York then, and... then came on back, but I didn't stop in Kansas City. But when the book came out then, Kansas City did the most wonderful thing for me. I didn't care after that if I never made a nickel on the book. I thought that the Lions Club would be the really big one, because the Lions Club's the ones that hoop it up, you know, and I'd been a Lion, you know. But it was the Rotary Club. It was the big one in Kansas City. Well, the Rotary Club had a luncheon for me. And they had... their membership was 620 people, and they had 680 in the old Muehlbach Hotel Grand Ballroom for the luncheon. When I got up to talk, I couldn't creep from crying. I said, I just want to tell you, this is the most wonderful moment of my life. I said, I started as a punk kid that wouldn't amount to much, and I still don't amount to much. But I think if my father and my grandfather's alive, they'd be pretty proud of me that I turned out for something, you know. And so I went ahead. What I was doing was there to talk about Union Station Massacre, because the book would be coming out about that time. And then I really was lionized in Kansas City. I don't like to brag about it, but the TV stations went all out. I was interviewed here, I was interviewed there, and the papers interviewed me, you know, on the... FBI saw that I wasn't hurt, and the police saw that I wasn't hurt, because I really let the Kansas City police have it in this book. And when we were through, the chief of police was on the table at the speaker's table, and he came up and he put his arm all around, and he said, Merle, he said, nothing's going to happen to you while you're in Kansas City.
What year was the book published?
In 1976.
Oh, it's been fairly recent.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were honored in 1976 in Kansas City.
Yeah, in Kansas City.
And he has promised to let me borrow that book if I take good care of it, and you may have it next if he'll let you.
Well,
I was just going to ask him. I think that that he would want us to read his book.
Well, I want to now. I'm curious. Really.
Well, as I said, I'm not a writer of fiction. I'm basically a writer of nonfiction, because...
Well, that's what we need now. Heck, Truman Capote said that the age of nonfiction was...
Well, I think one nice thing, which I was delighted for, not that he called on me, but here, when they did the 200th anniversary of the United States, the John F. Kennedy Center for Performing Arts did a thing, the history of the theater in America, and they broke it down into three segments, in the New York and the East, then the Midwest, and then the West Coast. And they came out here, and somehow they got a hold of Bill Eaton at the Globe Theater, and he told him that he thought that I would be the one that should do the thing. Well, I did it for the 200th anniversary, and all of the history of the whole legitimate theater in the West for the 200 years previous to that. And Mrs. Clayton and I were invited out to this big dinner that they gave afterwards back in Washington, D.C. at the... But I didn't, Ms. Clayton, and I didn't want to take one, go back there just to... But I was very delighted that I had been chosen to write the history of the legitimate theater in the West. And Neil Morgan has been after me for a long time to do a book on it, because there is a lot of glorious history about the theater in the West that everybody thinks of the theater in New York and in Boston and in the East. And really, there's an awful lot of wonderful material to be written on a really good book on the theater out here in the West, going from the start of it up to about 1935.
When you say about to the start of it, what were the origins of it here?
Well, if I was going to do it, I would start probably in about 1848.
Was Jenny Lind ever in San Diego?
Who?
Jenny Lind.
To my knowledge, no, but Lily Langtry was, which was a story in the San Diego magazine, which I think is a wonderful one. She appeared at, and I've got the date on my notes here on that, and she came here in her own private railroad car, and she was at the Grand Theater here, which had originally been the Lewis Opera House, but at that time it was the Lewis Opera House when the Jersey Lily was here on the thing, and it was the first time that tickets were scalped, actually, to get a ticket to get into the place to see that she was here for 2 days, May the 4th and 5th in 1888. And I've got the names.
For the benefit of the few who don't know who Lily Langtry was, tell the younger listeners who Lily Langtry was, because she was a famous woman.
Oh, well, she was quite a character around the world, and I had to take a long time to do this.
Well, briefly, what was the most important thing about her? Who was her favorite boyfriend?
Was King... I forgot.
Yeah, you got it.
You've got
King,
me.
King Edward the VII?
Oh, no, it was before that. No, it was before the VII. It was one of the King Edwards. I could go and get my notes on
it. It was Victoria's son, wasn't it? Or grandson?
Well, it was... in the 80s. Is when it was,
because it was said, the seventh, because it was
yeah.
The seventh.
And see, well, they'd made a movie, and of course they made movies on Lily Langtry, but John Huston did one with, what's his name? Paul Newman, and they used her in it, you know, when they did this thing on this Judge Bean. Down in,
oh, sure.
And he was in love with her. Of course, he'd never really met her, but he had her pictures all over his courtroom and everything.
The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean.
Yeah. But I think the wonderful thing was that they had this big parade down D Street, which later was Broadway, for when she was here, and people just clamored, and the women was beating their husbands with their umbrellas. They were standing there goggling with the Jersey Lil in a carriage being driven down the street, you know. And she came here in this fabulous railroad car, and it was parked down there when the old railroad station was down at the foot of 4th Street down there.
I was in a writer's workshop, and there was a gentleman in there, and of course was his favorite subject was Lily Langtry.
Mm-hmm.
Research material.
Well, I touched on it very much when I was doing the Opera House with No Opera, which I did on two theaters. I put that together, both the Leech and the Lewis Opera House, which were the first two actual theaters here. And the Lewis Opera House then was up on the 5th between C and B Street. Just a little above where Marston's was. It was upstairs there. And it was put up by a man by the name of Isidore Lewis. And I've got the opening date on it. Do you want the date on the thing? I had some notes with that.
Sure, I'm going to pause for a minute anyway.
Okay. The Lewis Opera House opened on Tuesday evening, March the 18th in 1887. Lily Langtry was there on May 4th and 5th in 1888. There. And later then, the theater was changed from the name of the Lewis Opera House to the Grand Grand Theater there. Then there was another theater was built over on 4th between C and B Street there, the Fisher Opera House. And that was built by a man by the name of Fisher, who made a fortune when he had the American rights to the all the girls. Now he made a fortune on. Anyway, the Fisher Opera House opened on January in 1892 there. And then it was actually, I thought of this Fisher. It was a Floridora Girls. And then later he lost his fortune. And then in 1920, Mrs. Tingley took it over, and she changed the name of it to the Isis there. And there was many, many well-known people appeared at the Fisher Opera House, and later at the Isis, which was, of course, the same theater there then. Then there was another theater that was built in 1904 by the name of the Pickwick. And it was on 4th Street, down there right across from the Grant Hotel, the grill there now. It was called the Pickwick Theater. And it was run by Fulkerson and Palmer, and Palmer Brothers. And Palmer Brothers and Fulkerson, they were related, had started a little theater down on 5th Street there at, let's see here, at 5th and F. An old saloon had gone out of business down there, and the Palmer brothers bought some seats out of a church out in El Cajon that had burned down, but the seats were in still good condition, and they were brought in and put in. Then later, was when this Wilde, W-I-L-D-E, who later became a mayor here, built the Pickwick and moved them up there. Then built the famous, well-known theater, the Savoy, which was known in San Diego for quite some time, and that opened in September of 1911 there. And that had a number of well-known people, especially Virginia Bussack, who later came here and was known as San Diego's sweetheart. But she opened the theater there. And one of the interesting things about it, we had in the magazine there two legitimate critical articles, which is reviews. And who do you think wrote them, who was living here? Anita Luce. And we have copies of those.
I was just going to ask you about Anita Luce, but I was waiting until you finished what you had to say, because I know that she went to San Diego High, and her father supposedly owned some theaters.
Yeah, he owned the... let's see here now how it was spelled. Rudwin, R-U-D-W-I-N. And that was Rudwin Theater, R-U-D-W-I-N, that is right. And that was down on the 6th and H Street there. And the one that the Palmer Brothers and Fulkerson had down on 5th was called the... the Lyric. And later it was turned into a motion picture house and was called the California before the recent California was built. But they had, the two had nothing to do with each other. But when you got into the time of the Isis and the time then later in 1911 of the Savoy there, you were into pretty good theater, because in 1912 then, John D. Spreckles had built the Spreckles Theater over on Broadway, which was then called Broadway.
I was going to mention to you, when you mentioned Wilde, that's Louis Wilde.
Yes.
Who defeated John D. Spreckles in the mayor's race.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we have a letter of Wilde that wrote to Virginia Bussack. I have about 200 letters that when she left San Diego, including one from Ham Marston's grandfather, George Marston, of thanking her and being a good customer. But they really loved her in San Diego. She opened the Savoy in 1911. Then she came back 2 months later and was up at the Grand. Then she went away. And then we're coming over to the... let's see here, what a leech, the Isidore, the Lyceum. Here we are. Into a theater in 1907 was built on B Street was called the Garrick. That was 1907, and it was the legitimate theater and had plays, but 2 years later it became the Empress and was a vaudeville house for cheap vaudeville by Considine and Sullivan there. And then it went kaput, and in 1917, Jack Dodge came over and leased the theater, the old Empress, and changed the name of it to the Strand. And he brought Virginia Brissac down here. And she stayed from 1918 until 1921. That was about the longest time any stock company had ever been in a theater. And she was here for 3 years. She was here every week during all that time. And her husband was John Ray, and he later went on to Hollywood and became a famous director. But I had the fun of interviewing Virginia Brissac. I run her down. I thought she was long deceased. And I ran into someone that knew about her that was related to the Dodges. And she was still alive. She was living up in North Hollywood. And she was then about 82 years old. And I went up and talked to her. And her mind was just as sharp. We had more fun. I spent a week of afternoons with her. And I was telling a gal that I knew in an agency up there, and I said, you know, I said, I've fallen in love with the most wonderful person. I said, she is just, and she looked at me, you old goose. And she said, well, what about her? And I said, well, she's 82 years old, Virginia Brissac. And when we were all through she gave me two of her pictures, and she said, Mr. Clayton, could I autograph those for you? I thought that's the most wonderful thing. Well, then she went with her daughter and granddaughter back to New Mexico. They got fed up with Hollywood, and she thought, well, she'd better go with them. Neither one were married. They were both divorced. And last year I got a Christmas card from her daughter and said, I'm sending this to you, Merle. Said, I think your grandmother would want me for you to have, and she passed away. But she lived to be up into her 90s. She was a terrific person, and I enjoyed so much of having the opportunity of meeting her and talking with her. And as I said, boy, she was just as sharp as a bell on the thing there. Then I did another series for the San Diego Magazine that kind of threw me off of the track, because a famous person lived out here at Alpine was named Julian Elting. And Julian Elting was the world's foremost female impersonator. So I did a thing on him, that run three articles on Elting. Well, he had appeared here at the Spreckles. He had appeared here at the, I believe he was at the Savoy during the time. See, after 1912 and then until 1925, the Savoy was not a legitimate theater in the sense of having plays. It was a Pantages vaudeville house until Pantages built his own theater here. Then it went back to the famous Savoy Stock Company.
What year was it he built the new theater, Pantages?
1925, which later became the Orpheum there. So I did this thing on Julian Elving, and I got to meet a group of wonderful people that lived up at Alpine that knew he and his father and mother. And then I run down another woman that lived up in Hollywood who he had put her through college. He never had any children, was never married, and he was Uncle Bill. His right name was Bill Walton. And to his friends, he was not Julian Elving at all. He was just Bill, and that was the name of the series. We called it Just Plain Bill.
Wow.
And make these people that, because he, as much as some people might have thought, Elding, while he was the world's foremost female impersonator, was not a homosexual at all. But he was never married. He had several love affairs, but he met this woman and her daughter, and took him in his big home, and she took me out and showed me the home that they lived in, and he put her through college, and she took me out to the cemetery and showed me where his remains was. I spent a whole, almost a whole day with her.
This is an Alpine.
Oh, no, this was up in Hollywood.
Oh,
this
I'm
was
sorry.
The who was then a woman that, and she referred to Uncle Bill putting me through college.
But Uncle Bill lived in Alpine.
Well, when he was not on the road, yes, he had this big home out here. And I went out and saw that, too. But there was a number of people that lived out there that knew him, was very close to he and his father and mother. And so I got some wonderful stories from them. And I got some nice correspondence. I wrote to Mae West and got a from her. No, she wrote right back that, well, only thing I wanted was, and I went up and talked to her, had she ever appeared in vaudeville with him. Same thing with Fred and Adele Astaire. And they wrote, Fred did, wrote back and said no. He said he certainly admired him, but he had never appeared on a bill. Well, then I didn't care to meet them or take up any of their time if they had worked with him. And the same thing, I had met a couple of times years before Jesse Lasky Jr. Well, Elton made about four pictures for Paramount, and at that time, Jesse Lasky Sr. was the guiding light of Paramount Pictures. And so I wrote to Jesse Jr., who was then living in London, and he wrote back and said, I wish, Merle, that you could talk to my mother. He said, she certainly certainly has all of her facilities. And we got to corresponding, and we had quite a correspondence on her remembrances of the time that Elding was at Paramount when he made motion pictures. So I was very, very fortunate in tracking these things down of... what it actually happened to people that knew something about it, and to be very careful to check my dates because I did want my dates to.
Sally Rand just passed away approximately a week or so ago. Did you ever meet Sally Rand?
No. Now, Sally Rand was usually in nightclubs, and the things that I did for the San Diego Magazine were only interested in the older theaters here. And, of course, after about 1942, when the Savoy closed for the last time then, San Diego never had a legitimate theater for a long time, and everything had to come into the Russ Auditorium over there. Then there was the Pickwick there. We've got that, the Lyric and the Redwig there. And then
who were some of the names, other than who you've already mentioned, that were prominent in their day that appeared here in San Diego?
Oh, my goodness sakes alive. Will Rogers was here twice at the Spreckles. Walter Winchell was twice at the Savoy in vaudeville. Al Jolson was here several times. Leatrice Joy was in the stock company for Virginia Brissac, as was... there's Leatrice Joy and Ferdinand Manure, who was very, very well known in pictures in those times. And well, practically every year, Mae Robeson came almost every year to the Spreckles there. Ethel Barrymore played there in the old days at the Spreckles. See, the Spreckles was, and I did the long article for that, so I'm just referring back again to that, is a magnificent theater. I hope that they don't destroy it, that it does become a landmark in theaters, because all of that marble in that lobby, John Spreckles brought from Italy on that thing. That stage there was the third largest in the United States. The largest one was the Hippodrome in New York, the Opera House in Chicago, the Spreckles Theater in San Diego, California. See, the stage is stage level with the street. And when they did Ben-Hur there, they brought the chariots in with the horses across the stage, run, come in from this doors here, across the stage and right out the back there. Well, Christ, you can stand on the stage and look up, and you can't see the top of the fly loft. That is five stories high.
That's true. Have you ever been to it?
I haven't been to it. It must be absolutely gorgeous.
It really is.
So I would hate to see that theater go, because it is...
There was quite an article, I think it was in the last 6 months, about the Spreckles Theater, and it still is rated as one of the top theater houses in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Acoustically good and
acoustically.
Everything.
Well, it was, because when they opened it and had the La Jolla Symphonic or whatever it was there, they asked me and Mrs. Clayton to come down as guests, which we did, and Jim Britton was there, who I know quite well, and we were just testing the acoustics or something, and the acoustics is still just terrific.
That's what they said in the paper.
Is the place a financial liability right now, or is it just...
Well, this woman that owns the property there, she's a real schnook of the first.
Isn't it just the first floor of a multiple floor building? Isn't it just part of
Speckles? Oh, yes. See what Speckles did? He built an office. Offices around it, and then let that help pay the cost. He didn't care whether the theater made any money or not. He just wanted San Diego to have a real nice, legitimate theater, and went out of his way to do this.
Was it completed before Radio City Music Hall or not?
Was it what?
Was it completed before Radio City?
Well, yes, a long time before, because it was completed in 1912.
Oh,
well.
I don't know what's upstairs now, but it used to be a lot of accounting offices and cigar stands.
I don't know what it all is in the building now there at all. But it was built as an... and see, the one to the east of it, Speckles owned that too, and that was the building for a long time that the Union Tribune is. And those two buildings are built identical, I mean, as buildings there. Because at one time, to get John D. Speckles to come here, they gave him a lot of land on the south side of Broadway. And for a time there, he owned practically all the land from the bay to 12th Street, with the exception of where the Bank of America stood. But of course, in later years, then it was sold off there. But at one time, he owned quite a bit of land there, which was given to him by the city to come here, which I think was a good investment, because Spreckles did a lot along, as so did Scripps, and so did Mr. George Marston. And don't forget George Marston, because what a lot of people might know, that he did a lot for San Diego.
Well, he certainly did.
He never wanted people to know anything about it. He never went around tooting his horn there. But the thing that I was more interested in anything else, and when I was talking on the phone, was that whatever you were doing to check your dates, that's the only thing that I was concerned in, was getting the actual dates on the thing.
I'm so glad that you're able to do that for us, because we've been uncertain in many, many instances on dates and things.
I've got, of course, a list of all of the plays and people that appeared in them for them that...
Who would you say, or what year did the organization of the Globe Theater start?
Well, the Globe Theater started, about 1937. When they first started, it was in the Puppet Theater down in the park. And see, now this is before my time. Again, I'm going back. During the exposition of 1935, the Globe Theater was built, and it had no roof on it, because it was built supposedly like the theater at Stratford-on-Avon in England there. That was the idea, and they had streamlined Shakespeare every day in there. Well, when the exposition was over, then they were going to tear the thing down. And a group of people, along with Mr. George Marston, now George Marston didn't spearhead it, but he was one of them, put up the money bought the building from one of the wrecking companies here on the thing. At the moment, I can't think of it. I do know who it is.
John Hanson.
No, it wasn't Hanson. It wasn't Hazard. It is a well-known one here.
David?
Well, it was... It wasn't Hancock, but it... they had a roof put on it, and then the Globe nonprofit organization took it over. And I wasn't here the first year, that when I came here in 38, then, the opening play for that year was Three Men on a Horse. And I had played Three Men on a Horse on the road. It was a well-known New York hit in 1936 there. And so they wanted me to... I'd went and read for the thing. And the funniest thing was, I really enjoyed it, because I was the only one that knew anything about what Three Men on a Horse was about. These characters here had never been in a book either. The whole thing was built on this little innocent fellow that was writing greeting cards, and he doped these horses on the bus coming and going to work, and they won all the time, but he never wouldn't bet any money on them. And he got discouraged and got drunk, and these touts found him in this bar and took him to the hotel, and then they kidnapped him and was using the, they had him to, and, oh, it's a wonderful play. And the part I had, I loved the thing, and it was, I wore a derby hat and smoked a cigar, you know, all that. But nobody else, one of the three fellows, or there's three men, one of them was Jim Holloway, who later was a part owner of Phillips Ramsey advertising agency here, and this Clarence Hoffman, whose parents owned the Hoffman Laundry. He was in it, and he and I and Jim Holloway were the three men, and Clarence came up and he said, "Merle, what is a three-horse parlay?" They're talking about all this stuff. Nobody knew anything about it. I'm running off on all of this stuff, and of course, I loved the play. I thought it was terrific. As I said, I wouldn't have did it when I did it, and I did it for stories, about 8 months on the road. At that time, they had road companies all over the United States. Only, I think they had five of it, road companies out here. They had one in Australia, and they had one in England.